So I think we're going to go ahead and get started. So my name is Scrooby, and I'm the coordinator of the MU-LGBTQ Resource Center here on campus. And thank you so much for coming. This is our keynote event for Transgender Awareness Week. We've had some really fantastic programs so far, so hopefully we've seen you at some of those. But we're going to, and there's still a couple more coming. So we have calendars and also some listservs if you want to sign up to get more information about anything, and buttons that you can take for free right over here on your way out. And so tonight we're going to be talking about trans identities, and we're very lucky to have Dallas Denny here with us on campus. If you listen to Inside Out today, our weekly LGBTQ radio hour, then you got to hear a little bit from her earlier, and you can always podcast that from our website. So she's a fantastic trans advocate, ally, writer, activist, and educator. So we're really lucky to have her here, and please enjoy.
Thank you. I'm going to talk tonight about trans identity. I had a choice of two topics, the trans representations in the media and trans identities, and I chose the former. If you look at my website, which is just my name.com, you'll find some stuff about media representations and slideshows I previously presented, and feel free to take a look. I'm going to start by talking about how things were when I was young, when there was a restrictive medical model in place that made things very difficult for us. And I'm going to end by talking about the present, where there's this diverse and varied community. I'm going to end by saying a word about the importance of preserving our history. You know, we live in a time now where we can define our gender the way we want to. You know, we can mix and match. We can, like picking fruit from a tree, I'll have one of these and one of those. We can use the pronouns that we wish to use. We can even make pronouns up. We can mix and match clothing and apparel. We can have a gender identity. A gender presentation is male one day and female the other. We can be genderqueer. We can blend. We can do whatever we want. And it's okay. It wasn't always that way. When I was young, we lived in an America with very restrictive gender roles, sort of a John Wayne, Marilyn Monroe dichotomy. And stepping outside of the box was dangerous. Most gay people were in the closet. Most trans people were in the closet. It was risky to stick your nose out. The reason things aren't that way anymore is because of people like us, you and me, and living authentically as gay men, as lesbians, as bisexuals, as trans people of every sort. It's a remarkable transformation that I've been lucky enough to witness in my own life. This is the cover of the Meet the Beatles album, January 1964. There was a huge furor about the length of the Beatles' hair. And you can see it's not even very long, but they were called the mop tops. Beetle wigs were sold in every kind of store. And they received a lot of ridicule because of their hair, which, as I said, just really wasn't very long. In the early 70s, pro defensive lineman Rosie Grier for the NFL wrote a book about needlepoint for men, and it astonished the world that a macho football player like Rosie could do something so ordinarily at the time associated with females. But I don't think they were willing to mess with him, so he didn't get too much grief, but he got a lot of publicity and appeared on a lot of TV shows explaining himself, which, of course, he didn't really need to do. It was just the society of the time. This wasn't a joke for trans people. We were tightly confined into roles and presentations that made us very uncomfortable, and we couldn't easily get out of them. It was a monkey wrench in all this, however. Transsexuals. This is Christine Jorgensen. She took herself to Denmark in the early 1950s, and news broke in December 1952 about her sex reassignment. She returned to the U.S. in early 1953 as Christine to a mob. This isn't even a tenth of the number of photographers who were there when she stepped off the Scandinavian airline plane. And she was hounded by the press for the rest of her life. Americans were presented for the first, actually people of the world were presented for the first time with the idea that sex might not be immutable, that it might be possible to change sex. That was a revolutionary idea, and that's why she knocked the H-bomb tests on the Eniwetok Atoll in the Pacific off the front page of the New York Times. When the transsexuals of the world learned, like everyone else, about Christine's sex reassignment, they said, they're like, hey, I need this sort of treatment. I need these hormones. I need this surgery. And they deluged her and her medical team with frantic requests for the same procedures. Her medical team, she had essentially talked her medical team into giving her the treatment. And they weren't prepared to do a second case. So what transsexuals did in the 1950s and early 1960s was find sympathetic physicians to give them treatment. This is Dr. Harry Benjamin. He immigrated to the United States in the early 1930s before the business with the Nazis. He was an endocrinologist. He had offices in New York and San Francisco, and he saw hundreds and perhaps thousands of transsexual patients, both male to female and female to male, who saw him for hormones and referrals. He was a very kind and sympathetic man. Transsexualism was met with stiff resistance from the medical community and especially from psychiatrists who called sex reassignment collusion with delusion and collaboration with psychosis, among other things. Those are actual quotes from papers from the 1950s. They argued that transsexuals were mentally ill and that the proper way to deal with people with mental illness was not to change healthy tissue, but to cure them. And they tried everything possible to cure them, including psychiatric medication, psychiatric hospitalization, aversion therapy, even psychosurgery, lobotomies and such. And none of it cured transsexuals. Sorry, I printed this in a font too small for me to see with my old eyes. Christian Hamburger was the lead doctor, an endocrinologist, I believe, in Christine Jorgensen's treatment, and he wrote about this problem. You know, it's like, it feels like we need to help these people in some way, and we can't really cure them. Harry Benjamin, in 1966... wrote a book called The Transsexual Phenomenon, in which he described a formal syndrome of transsexualism, which was characterized by a deep desire to change sex and a lot of mental anguish by being in a body that did not suit them. I believe that considering the time, that was the only possible argument he could have made that would have allowed treatment to continue in the medical community, but it created a pathology-based medical model that plagued us for many years and in some ways continues to plague us. We were patients. We were mentally ill. We didn't count except for whatever they decided to give us or do to us. Pretty soon there were more than 40 gender identity programs in the United States. By the mid-70s, there were more than 40. I wouldn't be surprised if there was one in Missouri. I want to make this personal now by showing you how crazy this is. I'm going to tell you something about, known only to me and Dr. Embry McKee of the Gender Identity Clinic at Vanderbilt Hospital at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. I'm not a transsexual, at least that's what Dr. McKee told me in 1978. Now, I'd just given the clinic $500 for the privilege of taking a battery of psychiatric tests I was trained to administer and could have given to myself for free. And they set me down, and that's what their Rorschach told them. I'm not transsexual. I'd asked the doctor for help in living as a woman, and it was clear that was not going to be forthcoming. They told me it wasn't going to happen because, wait for it, I wasn't screwed up enough to be transsexual. Now, if I'd gone for treatment for any other thing, being a stable human being, you know, a rational human being, a well-adjusted human being would have been a plus. but not for transsexuals. Not for me. I had 2 college degrees. If I was in such anguish, and I was having so much trouble dealing with my body that I did not identify with, then how had I managed to hold it together enough to earn a bachelor's degree and a master's degree? Not screwed up enough. I had a professional position as a protective services worker for the state of Tennessee. If I was in such pain, how did I manage to keep that job? Not screwed up enough to be transsexual. I've been married in the gender of birth for 6 years. How could that be? How could I be transsexual and have been married for 6 years? Not screwed up enough. I took myself to the medical library at Vanderbilt and read the literature, which was put out mostly by the people in the gender clinics, and it said essentially that Dr. McKee was right. Transsexuals were some of the most messed up people on the face of the earth. Now, the gender clinics pretty much turned everybody away who wasn't really messed up in some way or another and then wrote about them. That was the population of transsexuals. And from them came the literature that told me, yeah, Dr. McKee's right, you're not transsexual, but then why did I so desperately want to live as a woman? It wasn't easy to fly in the face of medical science, to disregard what I'd been told by the professionals, by the people who supposedly knew all about transsexualism. I didn't know a single transsexual person. I'd never found any literature that made sense, just the pejorative journal articles and books in the medical library. And it was tough, I tell you. And nevertheless, I found a source for hormones. I transitioned gender roles, and eventually I had surgery, flying in the face of medical wisdom. I realized, I think, that I was the ultimate authority on who I was, not them. And that's true for you. You're the ultimate authority on who you are, and whatever people tell you, you're the one who knows who you are. They don't, and they can't. But I think a lot about the thousands of people who went to the gender programs. The programs turned away about 80% of their applicants or more. And I think about the people who just got turned away and that was it, and lived lives of quiet frustration till they died. Very sad. So how did we get from the restrictive medical model that was in place in the late 1970s to this sort of splendor of gender that we have today, where people can be all over the rainbow? It was an interesting journey, and I took a small part in it. In 1991, Holly Boswell, who's an activist who lives in Asheville, North Carolina, wrote an article called The Transgender Alternative, and it was published in Transgender Tapestry, which is a magazine I eventually wound up editing, and Chrysalis Quarterly, which is a magazine I edited at the time. Both published simultaneously her article, which argued for an alternative to existing gender roles for trans people. Now, the reason that was needed was because those of us who were lucky enough to escape the boxes we came from wound up in boxes almost as restrictive in our own community. An anthropologist named Anne Boleyn studied a gender identity clinic in the western United States. It was in Colorado, in the late 1980s as part of her doctoral research, and found that when people came into this social and support group, they were expected to choose between one of 3 gender identities. You could be transsexual, you could be a crossdresser, you could be a drag queen. And if you didn't choose one, you were pressured to choose one. And if you chose one, then you were pressured to conform to the expectations for that box. So if you were transsexual and you chose that particular identity within the community, you started getting subtle pressures to take hormones, to transition from your peers. If you were a crossdresser and you started wondering, maybe I'd like to kind of see what hormones do, then that was like danger, Will Robinson. It was, you know, almost met with a panic. Holly's article had an immediate and dramatic effect. In 1993, Anne Boleyn attended the Southern Comfort Conference in Atlanta. This is barely 5 years after her data were collected in Colorado and found every sort of varied gender presentation. Just those three boxes were just demolished, and the community had done away with them. And just in actually in the 2 years since Holly had written her article, transgender had been a term that was batted around by people including Virginia Prince, who was an early cross-dresser organizer, and Christine Jorgensen, who we've talked about. But it never really stuck. It had just been used here and there, and suddenly it became the term that defined us. It was the one the media suddenly were using when they talked about our community. Before then, it might have been cross-dressers and transsexuals. Suddenly, it's the transgender community. And it became an identity. You know, I'm a transgender woman. I'm a trans man. I'm trans. So suddenly it was the term that defined us as an umbrella. And suddenly it was how we were defining ourselves. People who once would have described themselves as transsexual were now saying they were transgender. Same issues, different term. Now, the publication of Holly's article came about as part of a larger discussion in the trans community. We were looking for a term that we could live with that would define us. And we batted a lot of terms around. Virginia Prince suggested bigendered, and a WAG named Terry Fredrickson moved the hyphen over one and made it big-endered. And that was kind of the end of that. But transgender stuck. Now, everybody didn't like transgender. There are a lot of transsexual people who especially don't like to associate with other sorts of gender variant people, but it works as an umbrella term, and probably 95% of people are okay with the use of the term. And it allowed us to come out of those boxes we had been putting ourselves in and restricting ourselves. Now, that's how we got where we are today. When the floodgates opened, we were just kind of like water all over the plain. In this new age of freedom and gender identity and expression, how can we choose from the many identities open for us? What's right for you? What's right for me? Need we even choose? Are there cautions? Of course there's cautions. There are always cautions. First, some among us still have a deep and abiding desire to live as a member of the non-natal sex, and to do whatever we need to change our bodies to make that possible. That used to be called transsexuals. Some people that now do it call themselves transsexuals. Some call themselves other things. But the problems along the way are the same. If you take hormones, it's essential that you have medical help to monitor your blood chemistry to keep you healthy. That's whether you're on estrogen or testosterone. If you come out to your family, if you transition gender roles, it's extremely disruptive in your life. It's a major, coming out is a major event in your life. Transitioning is an even more major event in your life. You can lose friends. You can be rejected by your family. You can lose your job. You can get kicked out of your school, your church. It's just traumatic. You need all the support you can get, and whatever your label, you need that support. What we're all doing is managing our identities. Now, once that meant, I wrote a book about this, negotiating the way from living publicly as a male to living publicly as a female, or from living publicly as a female to living publicly as a female. Well, wait a minute. Anyway, both ways. But now it means different things to each of us. You know, today we might not permanently inhabit any particular gender. Some of us get up one morning and decide which gender we're going to present as. We can be genderqueer. We can deliberately be blending genders. We can be playing with gender as a statement of personal identity or as a political statement. We might not necessarily be trying to pass. And today we're no longer ashamed. We're proud and we show it. And we do it in lots of ways, and we modify our bodies as part of being proud. not only with hormones and surgery, but with piercings and tattoos. We just proclaim loudly who we are. And we do it in social media. We do it on the internet, in blogs, and in social media. And talking about identity today, one of the things I wanted to talk about, and I don't think it's been talked about in relation to trans issues by anyone, is our presentation on social media and what that can mean to us. Is Facebook free? I'm going to pick on Facebook. No, it's not. We don't pay Facebook money, but Facebook mines what we write for data, which it then sells to companies that use the profile Facebook generates to plague us with ads to try to sell us things they think we might be interested in. You know, new jeans, a car, a bank loan, diabetes medication. That's our economic profile on the internet, and it lasts longer than we do. On the other hand, Facebook doesn't care a lot about what we're saying on their site, except as to keep us there. So the Facebook posts kind of scroll out of sight on the top of the front of the page, and where do they go? How long do they last? I don't think anyone really knows. And worse, how do we preserve those? I mean, a lot of us do our coming out on Facebook. A lot of us have friends on Facebook and get a lot of huge amount of social support on Facebook and other social media. I'm just picking on Facebook. And the reason I'm picking on Facebook is because they're notorious for changing their privacy policies and opting you out of your privacy settings so that you're suddenly back in public and you don't even really realize it. And, you know, what you say on Facebook matters. I recently read about someone who was applying to college, and they were sitting in the class in an auditorium listening to the school do its pitch to get them to go to school there. And they were kind of trashing the school and trashing everybody without realizing that schools, they were tweeting. They didn't realize that schools look through tweets for their name. And so suddenly the admissions committee pulls up this person totally trashing the school, and they're like, you know. And that stuff is out there. It's permanent. You can't take it back. And they told me when I was 20 that by the time I was 40, I would be voting Republican, and I laughed. And yet, by the time they were 40, a lot of my friends were voting Republican, who I would have never thought would have voted Republican. So we don't know in 20 or 30 years, you know, we may be looking at getting a security clearance. We may look at beginning a big job for a Fortune 500 company. You know, our neighbor can look at us on Facebook and find stuff that we posted years earlier and get information about us. And, can, you know, there are haters out there, and people can get the information and use our lives, make our lives miserable. So I just wanted to say, be careful about what you post. Just consider that it's permanent. So think before you hit return, which is a good idea on the internet in general. So I just urge you to do that. I want to say a brief word about transgender history. 20 years ago, our history wasn't being saved anywhere much. It was in the hands of some private collectors. But we were famous in those days for purging, for throwing everything away because we thought we were sick. And we would get rid of all our books, our magazines, our clothes, our correspondence, and sometimes multiple times in the course of our lives. And no one was saving the history except for a few private collectors. Now there are places around North America that have big repositories of transgender information. Books, magazines, movies, newsletters, photographs, correspondence, you name it. But nothing is really being done to preserve our electronic histories. That means, you know, a lot of what I'm doing now, my stuff is preserved at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. But a lot of my internet presence is not being preserved at all. It just scrolls away off the top of the page. And, you know, right now, you guys are making history. And I ask you to start thinking about how you're going to preserve that, because, you know, you lose your cell phone and all the pictures you made of your transition are gone. You can't find your cell phone, and you never took the time to back it up. Or you forget the login on one of your social media accounts, or the company, God forbid, goes out of business and everything disappears, or the company decides, well, it's been 6 months, we're going to disband. That just happened to some friends of mine. To a friend of mine told me that they had a Yahoo group in which they were doing a lot of organizing and didn't get used for 6 months, and Yahoo just purged the group. So when he was turning to the group to put together a paper about their activity, he had only his memory. It was gone. So it's not permanent. So save that stuff because it's your history. And what you're doing now is trans history. And it needs to be saved. It needs to be treasured. And we need to figure out how to do it because I don't think anyone is even thinking about doing that now. And that's it. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Yeah.
I have one. I was just curious about like what year or like era you made your transition and how that went with like context with the culture and society at that time.
Well, when I was 13 years old, I knew I wanted to transition. I knew without a doubt. And yet, it was really scary. I mean, I felt like telling anybody would have been disastrous, and it probably would have been. I would have probably been drugged and hospitalized. My parents were very, very conservative. A lot of trans people in that situation back then, and people still do, they go into denial. I can't be this way. I won't allow myself to be this way. And they go into a very damaging self-denial, which can lead in adulthood to depression, alcoholism, drug abuse. I decided to hide it. That was damaging enough. I think I saved a lot of psychological damage by hiding it. So I would sneak away and cross-dress and go out. And I think I escaped a lot of damage by doing that. But it was tough. And I only transitioned when I deemed it safe. I mean, my clothes got found by my parents eventually. And they took me to the doctor at the hospital where I talked to the shrink and convinced him, oh, it's no big deal. I just do this sometimes. It's not important. I'm just experimenting. You know, it wasn't true. And he might have known that, but that sort of diffused the immediacy of the situation. But my family didn't deal with it. I didn't deal with it with my family. And when I eventually transitioned in the late 80s, I didn't see my parents again for 12 or 13 years. My father was dead. I never saw him again. I got a call from my mother after he had died, I think because she was bored or lonely. But it was tough. I mean, even when I came of age, I couldn't go to the drag bars in Nashville. They wouldn't let me in if I was dressed, and I didn't want to go if I wasn't dressed. I never had a transgendered friend. There was no internet. I went to the library in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, a town of 30,000 when I was 13, and they had two books. I looked up every term I knew, and they had two books, and one was in reserve, and I was petrified of asking the reserve librarian for a copy of the book, because then she would know, and then my life would be over. The other was in general collections, and I looked on the shelf, and it was gone, and I was still looking on the shelf after I'd graduated from high school, so the book obviously was stolen or lost, maybe stolen by someone like me, or maybe stolen by someone who didn't think people like me should exist, but I didn't have any kind of reference at all until the late 70s when the story of Jan Morris, who as James had accompanied Sir Edmund Hillary on the first... The conquest of Mount Everest, the first time Mount Everest was climbed, and Renee Richards, who was the ophthalmologist who got outed for playing women's tennis, and Wendy Carlos, who was Walter, did the first synthesized music album. Excuse me. That gave me enough information to go to Vanderbilt, and I already told you about what happened there. I contacted Trias in 1979. Trias is an organization for heterosexual crossdressers, and I saw them on TV, and I got their brochure, which very clearly stated No gay people, no transsexuals. We're for heterosexual crossdressers, and transsexuals and gay people are just not welcome. So I wrote them and told them I knew I wasn't eligible for membership and asked to be put in touch with someone who knew about transsexualism, and they gave me, of all people, Virginia Prince, who was notoriously anti-transsexual. And I poured my heart out in a letter, which she was kind enough to reply. I got a type letter back from her written all around the margins on both sides, and she returned my letter. So I have both letters, which I put on my website, and she scared the shit out of me, telling me I could never be a female. And she made a big distinction between sex and gender, which hardly anyone at the day was doing, so I thought she was telling me I couldn't transition. So it was 10 more years before I actually contacted Tri-S again, because I found nothing else in 10 years, and that time I joined, even though I knew I wasn't appropriate, because I figured, well, at least through there, if there are any transsexuals around that are like me, that aren't crazy, screwed up like Dr. McKee expected me to be, then perhaps I would find them. And I did. And that gave me the information I needed to complete my transition. I'd been on hormones for 10 years at the time. So over the course of a year, I had electrolysis to get rid of my facial hair and transition gender roles in 89. But man, that was when I found community. I was almost 40 years old. It was scary.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah.
You were talking a little bit about how mainstream medicine thought that transgender people were sick. Did you yourself ever kind of start believing that?
It was hard not to believe it. I mean, I guess I'm such a contrary person. So I go to this professional gender program, I pay them all this money, and they tell me, you know, I'm not transsexual. It would have been very easy to believe them, but I've always listened to my inner voice, and I said something about that on the radio program today. I only wish I'd wished to listen to my inner voice more often over the past year. So I just couldn't make myself do it, but it was probably close. And I think a lot of people just sort of went off after they got rejected by the clinics and never sought any help again, or maybe it was 10 or 20 years before they did. So it was a bad model for us. The other thing that model did, the clinics had very stereotyped notions about sex, so they required transsexuals to do some pretty horrible things, and they used the promise of hormones and surgery like a carrot on the end of the stick. So you have to do this or you don't get hormones. And sometimes you do it and you still didn't get hormones and then do it again, but they required people to get divorced who were happily married. They required people to quit their jobs that they were happy with, to get jobs that were more sex stereotyped toward their target gender. And they required them to dress and behave as sexual stereotypes. So if you were male to female and you weren't in heavy makeup and all kinds of jewelry and a dress, you know, and in fact, two sociologists, Wendy Kessler and Suzanne McKenna, quoted a doctor saying, like, if that transsexual doesn't turn me on as a man, then they're not really transsexual. So, I mean, it's a very horribly sexist thing to say, but they required people to be sexual stereotypes. And then we got pilloried by the feminist community for being sexual stereotypes. It was never true. What transsexuals learned to do was to give the doctors what they wanted. So you would get kind of on the transsexual grapevine. They would tell you, well, if you go to the clinic, you'd best be wearing a dress, you'd best be wearing makeup, and you best tell them you've been wanting to be this way since you were three, and you always played with dolls, and you always got picked on, and you're going to kill yourself. Then you might get treatment if you didn't. So transsexuals were very good at being what the doctors wanted because they wanted hormones and they wanted surgery, and it was just a very damaging thing. I've written quite a bit about that over the years. It makes me angry. I mean, you know, I had to go and find hormones without medical supervision because it was that or face masculinization for the next 10 years. I'm really glad I did, but now no one has to do that, and I work really hard so that people don't have to do that. Now you can find all kinds of doctors who understand and who don't think you're sick, and who will actually help you instead of putting a series of obstacles in front of you, and who won't consider you mentally ill.
So would doctors only give you hormones if they felt you were either sick or it was going to somehow, like, you were going to kill yourself or it was going to harm you in some way?
That was pretty much it in the gender clinics, because that was the picture they had. That was their idea of transsexuals, and it was self-reinforcing because transsexuals were the people they led into the clinics. And so if you got turned away, they would say, well, that's a cross-dresser, usually. You know, or that's a drag queen. That's not a transsexual. We know the transsexuals. We let the transsexuals in. So it was pretty bad. I don't fault Perry Benjamin for making that model, because I think it was the only way he could have justified sex reassignment in a way that would have not brought down the opprobrium of the medical community on him in the 1960s, but it did us a lot of damage. And still, there's a few hangers-on who believe in that model, whereas now most people are believing in a healthy transgender model, that being transgendered is just another way of being human, just like being gay is, just like anything, just like being redheaded is. Yeah?
Where do you see the trans rights movement in relation to where it was, you know, several decades ago, and in relation to the LGBT, I guess, part of the rights movement? Because I think we often conflate the two, but they're not, you know, necessarily.
Well, the communities were really separate and distinct in the early 90s. You know, and no one really had the T or the Q or the question mark or the asterisk after their names and their organizations. I remember going to the PFLAG tent at Atlanta Pride must have been 1992, and asking them about, do they work with trans people? And they literally were running around in circles consulting one another, trying to figure it out on the fly. And they came back and told me, well, if the person is gay or lesbian, then they're welcome to come. And I sent them literature to the chapter in Atlanta and to National, and National used it for a while, and then they developed their own trans material, and they've been great ever since then. I suspect I'm not the only person who asked them that question, but they got hit probably by two or three different activists about that time, and they responded really well. HRC was really not our friend for a long time, and I still wonder whether they are. But they stabbed us in the back a couple of times in a number of ways. When the first trans people was Phyllis Fry, who's she's a judge now, actually, in Texas. And I think Karen actually found themselves in Washington and actually went to some congressional offices in the early 90s and couldn't believe they got away with it. It's like, you know, because 5 years earlier, they would have been chased out. And the fact that they were actually able to go and talk seriously to Congress people, staff. But then Phyllis's conference, the transgender law conference in Texas, was going on. When we found out that HRC had gone around behind her back and gotten us removed from the things that they had managed, that Phyllis and Karen had managed to get us, to get inserted. And ever since then, it's been problematic with HRC. They seem to have been doing pretty well the last 5 or 6 years. I'm proud of them. I think they got enough pressure from their own grassroots that they reformed. But, you know, we're very well integrated now, although there's a lot of people with all the letters in the names, and they really don't have any trans people, you know. Some of them because they don't make trans people feel quite comfortable, and some of them because I just don't think they've had any trans people who come to them at all. So I give the, you know, what was formerly the gay and lesbian community a huge amount of credit for realizing. It wasn't always that way. I was just reading Out for Good downstairs in the GLBTQ office and reading about the trans people that were booed off stage at Pride celebrations in the early 1970s. It was pretty brutal, even though trans people were a huge part of the Stonewall Rebellion in 1969. 3 years later, they're being kept from speaking and booed in public and given a hard time. My talk, which will probably be in much better shape since I had a hard time reading it, will be on my website within a week. Feel free to visit. I have a lot of my stuff I've done up there. And I thank you for being such a good audience. Appreciate it.